New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show whenever you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking to Peter Vitale. He's the author of the book The Divine Home, Living with Spiritual Objects. Right now, I would like to welcome Attorney Jay Goodman. He is the president of the New Mexico Collaborative Practice Group and founder of Jay Goodman Associates. And Sandra Brittenall joins us. She's a certified divorce financial analyst. And Max August is here. He's a divorce and child coach, longtime marriage and family therapist, and founder of Children First Co-Parenting Support Services. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Radio Cafe.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mary Charlotte.
Good morning. So we are here to talk about divorce, which is the subject that is sad and tragic for many people, but you are doing it in a way that is different from the normal going to court. I don't even know if you can call it normal, but going to court and having litigation battles. You're doing something called collaborative divorce. Jay, what is that?
Well, collaborative divorce is designed not to go to court at all. It avoids the time, the expense, the polarization, and protracted legal battles that are involved in standard litigation within divorce. There's an agreement not to go to court. We work as a team, and of course we have some of the team members here. The idea is to get a comprehensive result that is client-centered and focused on their values.
And so how do you, in other words, what incentives do you provide for people to settle their differences in a way that stays out of court?
Well, basically, it reaches for people's highest motives and intentions, and that's a lot better than fear-based, which is involved with litigation. So we use mental health professionals, we use child specialists, and financial advisors to help and avoid all the fear that goes into litigation.
And one of the things that you do is, instead of lawyers having to figure out what's going on with everybody and doing discovery and all of that, you have everybody put their cards on the table in the first place.
Absolutely. You know, there's a thing in litigation called discovery where, you know, the lawyers have discovery battles. They have interrogatories and requests for production documents, requests for admissions, sometimes depositions. And you have two lawyers at their rates battling it out and trying to get the information where some people try to hide the ball. Whereas with collaborative practice, everybody agrees from the very beginning to put all their cards on the table. Saves a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of heartache.
Do they really do it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Do you ever find that somebody didn't put their cards on the table?
It's pretty easy to find that out. And that's why we have many other team members to try and pull it all together. If we feel that somebody's withholding information, there's things that we can do about that, like withdraw from the process completely. And so there's quite a bit of negative incentive to make sure that people do. But I have found the majority of the cases really... people want to come in, they want to get it over with, they want to do it quickly, they want to get it resolved thoroughly. So they comply with full disclosure.
So what are the main reasons that people actually get divorced?
Well, there's the classic ones with infidelity or drug abuse or alcohol abuse. There's gambling. Those are the main things from my point of view.
Max?
I just wanted to would classify all those things as a divorce coach and ex-marriage and family therapist under the big umbrella of betrayal of trust.
Yes.
That's like the bottom line, and it could be because of infidelity, could be because of money, could be because of the way children are being raised, could be gambling, could be addiction, or, you know, those are all betrayal of trust that it really boils down to.
It also comes down to sometimes mismanagement of money as well. There are individuals who have just thrown up their hands and they're so far in debt and they can't trust the other spouse, and it's just time to walk away, and that's where they make that decision too. So it is under that umbrella.
I think one of the things that people often don't know about each other when they do get married is how the other person deals with finances.
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And that gets into the idea of perceived versus actual trust. Mm-hmm. A lot of people have assumptions going in, and they feel that those assumptions should be met by the other party, their unvoiced expectations. And there could be differences in temperament, and people feel that they've been betrayed.
Mm-hmm. It's also not an understanding of how to raise children. So if children come into the family, one parent who's been brought up a certain way might have totally different ways, and they haven't talked about it. So that becomes a big issue quite often.
What about people who just simply grow in different directions? No trust has been betrayed, but one of them decides that their path is evangelical Christianity and the other one is really grounded in their atheism, and they didn't really know how different that was when they got married.
Well, that is, I consider that betrayal of trust, because somebody, we all believe that somebody's going to stay the way they are, or they're going to change the way we want them to change. And we trust that they're going to either do one of those two things, and if they don't do those two things, then we...
But they didn't do anything that was really
no,
a betrayal.
It's not. It's an internal betrayal.
Misperception.
It's a misperception. It's because we have an expectation that they're going to stay the same, or that they're going to change the way that we want them to change.
So what are the things that you see, the reasons for divorce that you see most among the clients who come in for collaborative practice, collaborative divorce? Is it, I mean, do you see mostly drugs and alcohol? Do you see mostly adultery?
We see a whole mixed bag of that. It's a whole mixed bag. But I think Max is absolutely correct on the trust issue. It's perceived versus actual trust. And something that Sandra mentioned, mm-hmm. a lot about the money management. That's a big issue for a lot of people.
So what does the, Sandra Britnall, what does the financial coach actually do in a collaborative divorce practice?
I guess what I would say, first of all, is I'm one of the first people that a couple contacts after they've made this decision that they're going to move on into a divorce. The process usually is a couple has decided that they've reached an impasse and they can't move farther into their marriage or heal any wounds. And so they see an attorney or they see a counselor or they see a mediator or they see a therapist. And that then first person that they see guides them toward someone like me who helps them understand the financial ins and outs of what divorce really means. And so I work with them to help them understand or to learn where their assets are, where their debt is, and help them be very clear about the decisions that they're going to make as they move from one household into two.
Do you ever, any of you, get into a situation where you've got two spouses and one of them is clearly just a how should we say it on the radio, poop head, and the other
you can say that on
a poop head. Oh gosh.
And the other one is really the injured party. How do you not take sides? Or does it not come out that way?
It doesn't come out that
no.
way. You know, a lot of times people come into the office and they'll try and demonize the other party. But it doesn't typically work out that way. It's different perceptions, and you know, people have their perceptions about how that is, but there's two sides to every story.
And that's in a majority of cases, but there are cases like you're pointing out, Charlotte. And those cases...
When
they're real poop heads don't quite make it through the collaborative process. That does happen. The collaborative process does fail. But the great majority of people are really good people in difficult situations. They're trying to make their way through something. They're trying to get to a new life and start something new. And that's what they're trying to do, but they don't have necessarily the skills, or they've bought into a paradigm or a model that is put out by the media, by their friends, that it's supposed to be a battle. You know, we've got the movies like The War of the Roses, if you remember that movie, Kramer versus Kramer. Those, you know, portray divorce, which is a normal life transition. You can count it as that because of the great percentage that we have. But they think it has to be a battle. It does not have to be a battle. And many people do, without our aid whatsoever, get divorced without having to go through a battle.
You know, one of the fundamental premises of collaborative practice, which differs from litigation, is we affirm in collaborative practice the inherent dignity of the highest goals of each person. So they're expected to reach to a higher level, and a lot of people do.
Most people can do that.
Especially in light of children.
Well, that's the next question that I had. And I mean, Max, you're a what's called child coach for people who are going through divorces. The children, in a way, are the most vulnerable parties when parents are getting divorced.
That's correct. In the old way of divorce, the children were perhaps, if it was done well, sat down with by the parents, and it was explained that the family was going to be a change, it was going to be different. And what we're doing is we're giving more attention to the children by, number one, having a child specialist meet with the children maybe 2-3 times. It's not therapy. It's definitely not therapy. It's a time for the children to talk about with somebody that's outside of their home, a professional who understands what they're going through and can help them adjust to the transition. And then the information that the child specialist hears can be taken back to the team, because we work as a team, and used to facilitate the construction of a parenting plan, which is how much time the child spends with mom, how much time the child spends with dad, and that sort of thing, based upon more of the needs of the child. So there's two aspects of the work that I do. One is that, and the other part of the work is working with the parents and helping the parents become more cooperative with each other to be parents, to get into a business-like relationship. And the business is raising their child or children. And they don't have to like each other. Matter of fact, they probably don't while they're going through the process. They don't have to be friends, but to get in that business-like relationship. So that's the other aspect of the work that I do. And we do that first by addressing the emotions. There's emotions in divorce that are very high, as we all know. And a lot of those emotions come out of the grief process. Even the person who is the one who's leaving, because often it's one or the other, it's very rarely by mutual agreement that they're going to get a divorce. The one who's leaving has probably started the grieving process
earlier,
mm-hmm. but they're still in it, and they have to recognize that the other person might be in a different place than they are. And that's a very important piece of it, because they expect, well, I'm ready to go, let's get on with this. And we have to go at the rate that the slowest person wants to go, mm-hmm. or can go, because of that grieving process.
Now, I've known cases where the children were delighted that their parents got divorced.
Absolutely.
Because they couldn't stand the fighting anymore.
Absolutely.
And then others where they wanted nothing more than for their parents to stay together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Even in those cases, those that are really happy and really good, there's still a remnant, because especially if it's not handled well between the parents. If one parent puts down the other parent and continues that after the separation and after the divorce, that will be very damaging for the children. So it's really a double bind for them. They feel relief in those situations that they're getting the divorce, but then that they continue to hear that sort of thing, and it's really the most traumatic experience for the children.
What kind of problems and vulnerabilities do you see the children having, and what kind of acting out do they do?
Well, their risk goes up from 3 to 5 times on many, many different indicators of risk areas. Behavioral problems in school, academic problems in school, alcohol and drug use, the rate of use of mental health professionals later in life, and probably because they're having poor relationships with other adults, either at work, or in an intimate relationship. So all of those things are really greatly increased when there's a continued conflict within the home after a separation and divorce.
So if there's a high divorce rate in the year 1980, then in the year 2000, the therapists make good business.
That's right, exactly. And that's what I found in my practice. And my practice as a marriage and family therapist was, that's why people were coming to me. And if I looked at their history, they came from families, not always divorced, because sometimes people stay together and continue the conflict. But it's the conflict and the children being exposed to that. It's almost like post-traumatic stress syndrome.
Right.
Children are continually being re-traumatized, and they can't get out of it. And so they carry that into adulthood.
We're talking about collaborative divorce with Jay Goodman, Sandra Britnall, and Max August. The question of finances, does it become worse? Do you expect to see more problems leading to divorce in the kind of situation, economic crisis that we're in right now, Sandra?
Good question. It's going to be interesting to see how it all evolves, because some people feel that where they are right now, they can't get divorced because they can't sell their assets because nobody has the money to buy them. So here they are in a situation that they're going to just endure. And then you can look at it on the other hand, saying things are so bad right now, maybe it'll be better if I'm on my own. So it can go either way.
I do. I am very close. The connections with the courts. I work with the courts very closely. That's the first judicial district here in Santa Fe. And they've told me the divorce rates are up.
Even just in the last few weeks.
Yeah, in the past few months, through the summer.
Financial stressor is a real big cause of divorce. I have also seen people recently, given the economy, that are just too afraid to get divorced. However, that's not a very good reason to stay in entrenched, persistent conflict, because it typically just gets worse and worse and worse.
When we talk about expectations, you were mentioning that Kramer versus Kramer and the kind of divorce battles that we see in the media and people expect it to be like that. I think there's also expectations about marriage that come from the media and come from all sorts of roles that we learn through TV and through literature and through all of that. And maybe those aren't so realistic either.
Mm-hmm.
Walt Disney, happily ever after.
Right.
Lots of myths perpetrated in society, religiously, through the media, through all kinds of sources.
And then when it turns out not to be that way, people say, I'm out of here.
People get very, very disappointed, and sometimes it's contextual, sometimes it is circumstantial, but they tend to turn on one another.
Now, do you ever see in your practice reconciliations?
All the time.
Really?
We see it in a higher incidence of cases with collaborative practice, because with collaborative practice, people don't litigate and they don't get as polarized.
So without giving away any details, tell us a couple of stories of reconciliations through the kind of practice that you do.
Well, almost the first, the very first case that I did about 4 years ago ended up in reconciliation. It was, we had just started doing collaborative practice here in Santa Fe, and they were having difficulties with children going into their teen years. So, and that becomes a difficult time. What we find is when there's big life transitions, like children going to teen years, different job changes or changes in location, those are stressors on the family. So this family had tried marriage and family therapy before, but they quote said it didn't work, so they were going to get a divorce. So they went and got their attorney, and then the attorney recommended a divorce coach, and I started working with them. And in about 4 or 5 sessions, they saw, wow, we're not that far apart. we can figure this out. We can work this together. All we need is some better communication skills and some understanding of what going into teen years is all about and how we as parents need to work with that.
Sometimes on the financial side as well, you can get closer to reconciliation when people realize what they can and can't do with their money, and all of a sudden it becomes... not such a high mountain to climb, and they realize that if they change their budget strategies a little bit or cut back a little here, that maybe they can actually work something out. And I help people develop their own personal budgets as well as family budgets as well. And so some areas of discontent can actually be smoothed over with smart strategies.
With married couples, they can restructure their marriages. It's important for people to realize it's not an all-or-nothing proposition. There are things called prenuptial agreements that a lot of people hear about. There's a lot of things called postnuptial agreements. Married people can contract with one another. And if it's a financial thing that's the major stressor within the marriage, they can restructure it. Separate bank accounts. So there's many things that can be done.
Do you ever see people just taking a sabbatical from each other and then coming back?
Separations, people do it all the time.
And then come back together.
Sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't.
I've always thought sabbaticals would be a great idea.
Time to take a break.
I always thought it'd be a good idea to have a time-limited contract.
Right, you stay married for 10 years, and then you have
redo it, yeah, either redo it or not.
Now, you're talking about married couples. Do you ever work with either gay couples who aren't officially married or... heterosexual couples who are living together but also not officially married?
All the time. Within the area of gay, lesbian, and transgender couples, they're not really protected as well as they could be by the state of New Mexico. Although New Mexico does not have DOMA, which is the Defense of Marriage Act, which is enacted in 41 states, there is not a lot of protections. Married people can't get divorced. So there's nevertheless, people are people, and they have conflicts. They need to be resolved in a productive way. So we do work with those particular populations, as well as there are not a lot of people getting married. Heterosexual people are not getting married as often, statistically.
Right. So, and not as young.
Not as young, yeah. It's very, very important to recognize that. So these folks need to consider what they need to do in the conflict situation to productively resolve their rights.
And the never married couples really could benefit from the collaborative process rather than running and getting an attorney. We're seeing in our Children First programs, when we do co-parenting workshops, an increase over the past 5 years. It was maybe about 20% at the beginning. Now it's close to 35-40% of never married couples that are in court battles, and they're doing it pro se, meaning by themselves, no attorneys. Some of them are with attorneys, and they're battling over child visitation, child custody, child support, and they could get they could do it a lot more constructively with the collaborative team working with them.
Something to keep in mind is there is a pro se crisis here in First Judicial District. The courts are getting absolutely overwhelmed by people doing filings, domestic filings of all sorts and natures. These things take a long time for the courts to hear, and it can be resolved a lot quicker and a lot more facilitated of people getting agreements that they can live with by themselves through the help of collaborative practice.
Now that brings up a question. What is the difference in actual outcome between an agreement that's arrived at through collaborative practice versus an agreement that's arrived at through litigation?
Well, about 98% of the cases that go through litigation end up getting settled anyway. Unfortunately, a lot of times through financial attrition. However, say with a marriage, for example, you have a marital settlement agreement, you have a parenting plan, and that gets typically incorporated within a final decree of divorce. The thing is, you got to wait through all these hoops and procedural Byzantine procedures that a lot of people don't understand. Whereas with collaborative practice, through the use of other professionals, mental health professionals, financial professionals, child specialists, and the like, people can hammer this out, and the lawyer actually provides a structure to have a legally recognizable agreement that, of course, is essentially the same, but there's a lot more things that can go in a marital settlement agreement and a parenting plan that the courts can't consider because their hands are tied by the legislature in case law.
Now, yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to, Jay mentioned again the mental health professionals, and I just want to make the point, because a lot of people have concerns about this, the mental health professionals are involved not because it's a mental problem, but we're actually not doing therapy or counseling even. What we're doing is coaching, and in a way consulting, but mostly coaching. And the coaching is in the improved communication.
What is coaching? Coaching is one of those like made up new words that uses sports team metaphors.
Yes, it's a sports team metaphor, right. Well, what does a coach do?
Well, when I was a child, there were no coaches except for sports.
Exactly. And what does a sports coach do?
I wouldn't know.
Okay, a sports coach brings out the best in somebody who has certain skills. And every professional athlete has a coach because they want to perform at their highest level. You know, they're good at doing what they do, but they want to be even better. And a coach is able to give guidance in what will help them be better.
Well, I mean, honestly, you're also dealing with people who are traumatized.
Exactly. That's why a mental health professional is used for this. Because a mental health professional knows how to deal with the deep emotions and the stress that people are under and can help people through that while they're coaching. So the coaching is to get the people to be at their best, as Jay has mentioned so well at the beginning of our talk, that's what collaborative practice is, to call people to be their best. Well, they can't be at their best because they're under so much stress and emotion, but coaches can help them perform because they know how to do that. Everybody knows how to be good under a lot of stress.
Another word for coach, you can think of it as a facilitator.
Mm-hmm.
And that
for those non-athletes among us?
Yes. Yes.
But a coach also is someone who helps one clarify goals, gets very clear on it, and then helps to problem-solve steps to get you to that greatest good, to that point that you want to be. So, yeah, a coach is a facilitator, a coach is an encourager, but a coach also is able to see the larger picture and can help you as the client visualize the end goal.
And a coach has been in the divorce process, been through the process many, many times without it. And there's no advocacy or position Right. You know, that a coach takes. A coach is neutral in terms of wanting to help the client just be their highest self.
Now, sometimes you do use mediators, professional mediators. Under what circumstances do you call in the mediator?
A lot of times a mediator can reframe issues when there's extreme contention.
So when people are really mad really entrenched and won't let go.
And team members might get, like the professionals.
Oh, okay.
Because we're human. We're not perfect.
Ah, so the mediator will help you guys out of your little whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If there is an impasse, a mediator is very, very useful in reframing the issues in such a way as to get people back on track.
So, do you ever come across cases where there are truly irreconcilable differences?
That's why they come in the door. If they were reconcilable, they typically wouldn't hit my office, that's for sure. People perceive the differences as being irreconcilable when they come in. A lot of times they learn different communication styles and support in dealing with the root causes of the conflict. A lot of times they reconcile. If they don't reconcile, they have a legacy that goes beyond the divorce for the benefit of their families and their children that is much, much more positive.
We're talking about collaborative divorce. Now, I think it's important to talk for just a moment, and you alluded to this before, Jay Goodman, about how at this point in the history of our culture, of our society, divorce is not so much... excluding the question about children, which is a very long conversation, but for the adults involved, is not necessarily a tragedy. It's a transition that sometimes ends up with both parties better off.
It can be enlivening. It can help take a great weight off, a millstone, as it were, off of people's lives so that they can truly flourish.
What's your perception of that, Sandra?
Well, I think that it's very common that people get to a certain point in their lives where you're not the same person that you were before. And as you review where you've been and where you want to go, is this the right partner for you to be? And if you're able to change together, and, you know, all of our lives are nothing but change. So if you can change together, that's wonderful and that's growth. But if one or the other party can't, then there's obviously a move in different directions, and it's natural and it's not a bad thing. A clear recognition of who you are as a person.
Yeah, a divorce is a normal life transition, and I have an interesting statistic that I can't reference it right now. I could find it for you if you want. Back at the turn of the century, the last century, 1900, the average marriage lasted for 8 years. 8 years.
8 years?
8 years.
What, because the life expectancy was 40?
Exactly. Life expectancy was lower. There was also the ability to abandon people very easily. If you recall at that time, there were lots of orphans working in sweatshops. And that's why we have the child labor laws that came into place around the 1900s. Those orphans were there because death of parents and also abandonment. Parents could easily go out west and disappear. We didn't have the same kind of tracking materials as we have now. So this idea that marriage then should last for these long periods of time is relatively new. There's only a small window that's been the case.
Where we have the medical antibiotics and so on to give us the life expectancy to where we're then supposed to fulfill it with one person for 50 years.
Exactly. And unless we're willing to recognize that and then learn to grow and change with each other and adapt, and if we go in different directions, understand that's... And many people are able to do that, actually. But there are still some who don't recognize that. They're kind of getting entrenched and stuff.
And many for whom divorce still is a pretty terrible stigma, and for whom it is considered a failure.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Many people still carry that, even the most hip people who see it this way as a transition. Still, somewhere inside, because the culture has put that out there so strongly.
Do any of you ever feel like writing a novel or making a movie based on the dramas that you see?
No.
No.
No. I mean, you see things that nobody else sees in your office.
Actually, I wrote a screenplay.
Did you? Buying?
Yeah, I did. Based upon my work as a marriage and family therapist, it was about cloning, and the basic idea was that is... because I still have it, I'm still working on it, is that parents want their children to be exactly the way they are, and so this got carried away by the scientists who decided to clone children, and that was his whole reason for living. And so he could have somebody just like him, a mini-me, right? And it's the mini-me idea. Michael, you know, who did the mini-me? Michael Meyer. That, I think, was a great satire on that concept. I mean,
it's an old idea, parthenogenesis.
Old idea. Exactly. And I think that's where parents mostly get into problems when they're raising their children, is that they want the child to be just like them.
If they only knew about genetics and the wild variation.
That's right.
That two people can produce. So we're coming to the end of our time together. If people would like more information, I guess they can go to the website nmcollaborativedivorce.com, or they can find out from the national website, which is collaborativepractice.com. I guess this is a national movement.
It's an international movement. The secondary website that you just gave was the International Academy of Collaborative Professionals. We also have in this state the New Mexico Collaborative Practice Group. Here in Santa Fe, we have Santa Fe Collaborative Practice Group. So this is quite widespread, but it's important that the practitioners that people choose are collaborative practitioners and that they are specially certified and have the additional training that's required to do this properly.
Jay Goodman is the president of the New Mexico Collaborative Practice Group and founder of Jay Goodman Associates. Sandra Britnall is a certified divorce financial analyst, and Max August is a divorce and child coach. He's a former marriage and family therapist and the founder of Children First Co-Parenting Support Services. I want to thank you all so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte.
It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
You
too.
Bye. We're going to take a little break right now. We'll be right back. Please stay tuned to KSFR. I would like right now to welcome Peter Vitale. He is the author of the book, The Divine Home, Living with Spiritual Objects, and he will be at Garcia Street Books on Thursday, the 30th of October, from 5 to 6 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
Now, you are a Santa Fean. You're out of town right now, but you'll be back very soon. And this book, you're a wonderful photographer. It contains many photographs of the interiors of people's houses and text about them and how they use religious objects in their homes. How did you come to do this book?
Well, I began by really taking note once I moved to Santa Fe about all the numbers of beautiful houses there of people collecting religious art. And it's mostly, I think, a regional obsession in a way. It's more indigenous to the Southwest, I think. And I sort of did grow up with some of these objects, but I'd never seen it to the extent that I've seen it in the Southwest. And then I kept seeing more and more of it, and I just became entranced. And so I just started photographing them for my own enjoyment, and little by little it turned into a book.
What does it mean to use religious objects as decorative elements for interior design? Did they lose their religious significance?
You know, they do it to an extent, but they are still sort of imbued with that kind of spiritual quality that I think is appealing and attracts people. I think it's twofold. It has that kind of, you know, what it represents on one hand, but the objects in themselves are just so beautiful that I think they stand alone on artistic merit.
It's, I suppose, no surprise that Catholicism provides a whole lot more beautiful objects than Protestantism.
This is true. Those crazy Catholics.
and opulent and passionate Catholics.
Well, just look at the Vatican, you know, and the way they dress and their ceremonial, everything about them is a little bit over the top.
So, especially here in the Southwest, a lot of people who may not be practicing Catholics themselves collect crosses and saints.
Oh, absolutely. I've known Jewish people who collect crosses and saints, quite a few. You'd be surprised.
What is the people whom you're photographing are real collectors. So talk about that process of collecting religious objects specifically.
Well, I think once people get excited by religious objects, they start buying and then they just start refining their collections. And before you know it, I think they can't get enough. I mean, they're at all the antique shows and they're calling and they're on eBay and they're looking for more and more because, you know, there is a finite number of these objects. In particular, some of the reliquaries are hard to come by. So people will devote quite a lot of time researching and finding objects either online or at antique shows or antique shops.
We're talking to Peter Vitale, author of the book The Divine Home. Are some of the people in your book using objects that do represent their own religious background and faith?
Yes, absolutely. And a number of the people who are in the book are religious. But surprisingly, when asked about why they collect this type of art, it has not a lot to do with their religious beliefs. It really has to do with the aesthetic, artistic merit of the individual pieces that they collect.
Are you a collector yourself?
I am. I go in and out collecting various, various aspects of the religious art. I used to have a pretty sizable collection of silver crowns or halos that go on tops of saints' heads. And at this time, I have quite a large collection, probably the largest collection of anyone I know, of ex votos, which are their hearts. They represent the passion of Mary and Christ, and they're either brass or silver, and I have quite a large collection of those, and I keep looking for those.
What do they, how are they used in a religious context?
They were, they actually come from just very one small area in France, in the south of France, near Saint-Tropez, actually, and they were made in the 19th century, predominantly, and people would commission them. They range anywhere from about an inch and a half, 2 inches probably, to anywhere to 10, 12 inches in size. But people would commission them pretty much to give thanks or as a favor back to the church for maybe maybe an illness that was cured. You know, it was always in thanksgiving for something that they believed that the Almighty had helped them through, a disease, whatever you have. And they would commission these little hearts, and they're three-dimensional, and in the back there's a slot where you would write a little prayer or a little note of thanks and fold it and put it into the slot, and then you would present that to the church, and the church would display them somewhere inside the church. And that's really the background to that.
It's very interesting to me, the use of religious objects as religious objects versus the use of them as art. I read a book once by the writer Alan Herrera, who was writing about the Kogi Indians of northeastern Colombia, and they were the only Indians in the Americas that never had anybody converted to Catholicism, and they had these objects, many of which were stolen from the Spanish and put in museums. And these people would go to the museums and grieve because they could not use them, and they would lose their whatever that energy was that was imbued into them when they became art objects. And I think they finally made an agreement to get some of them back and replace them with replicas, because these were to them as useful as a bowl or fork is to us. I mean, an actual object with a purpose.
Right.
And I wondered, you know, what your take on that was.
Well, you know, the objects, for the most part, that people have collected that are in the homes in this book were never meant really to be used in a utilitarian fashion. They were always meant to be art. For centuries, actually, the only art was of a religious nature, and they were in the form of paintings or statues, and they were meant to be admired and something that people could look at and then aspire to a life, let's say, of a more saintly life. So I don't think they were ever intended to be used in a practical sort of way. I think they were always intended to be art that inspired people to be more religious.
And do you think people whom you have, for example, photographed for this book are using the religious devotional objects in that way still?
Oh, absolutely. I do. I think, you know, they can't get enough. They love it really for the purely artistic value that they have, for the aesthetics.
Some of the pictures, I have to say, made me laugh. There's one of a life-size St. Michael statue overlooking a very beautiful dining room table, and for all the world, he looks like he's hungry.
I'm sure that's a happy accident.
One thing that was interesting, there's one picture of a Virgin of Guadalupe. Is this, the book that you have made is obviously there's a lot of wealth, people with very beautiful houses and with a lot of money to do collecting. The Virgin of Guadalupe is more of a universal cross-cultural thing. Is that something that you saw much in the houses that you were photographing?
Well, you know, you see more of that. I think the Virgin of the Guadalupe is probably more dear to the hearts of folk art collectors, in a way. So you see a lot of it in the Southwest, and as you venture away from the Southwest in Mexico, maybe you see it's predominantly in Mexico. You begin to lose that. But there was something that you just said that I wanted what you said about the beautiful homes in the book. The homes that I did choose for this book are not just because these people collect this kind of art. It's because they've integrated it in such a way that it becomes a whole design, a design aesthetic that is a beautiful marriage between the interior design and decoration of the home and all the art objects that they've collected. So that's really where what I wanted to display in this book.
Now, some people collect objects from a lot of different cultures and religious traditions and mix them all together.
That's true. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that confuses me. I mean, not that it confuses me in a way that I don't really know particularly what all the different religious icons, what they represent. So sometimes I can confuse one region of the world with another. But I think these objects, if they're beautiful in themselves, I think they work with any other objects that are beautiful. So I think that part is fun, too, because there are collectors who are featured in this book who are, I guess I'd call them, pan-international or something like that. I mean, they cover all different religions.
We're talking to Peter Vitale, author of the book The Divine Home. Tell us more about some of the New Mexican traditional objects in the book. For example, the wooden santos.
I think some of the Mexican santos are the most coveted of all santos. For many years, people were able to get them out of Mexico. They were able to find them. The Mexicans have just a beautiful sensibility when it comes to the carving of their saints. The expressions are so gentle and just lovely. And for many years, North Americans would either go to Mexico or they'd find Mexican santos in the United States. But they've become very rare and difficult to find, so that is unfortunate, but they still do exist, and I love them.
What about the specifically New Mexican santos?
Well, those are so rare. I can't remember the exact story. Was it Bishop Lamy or someone like that? You know, forgive me for not being up on my history, but one of the bishops, I believe, outlawed a lot of folk art or saints that were misrepresentative, I believe, of what the Catholic Church was trying to imbue. And I believe he had a lot of them destroyed at some point in time in New Mexico. So the New Mexican ones are quite rare.
There is a living tradition now of people making
of new
beautiful
ones. Yes, that's true. Yes, that tradition does carry there. A lot of santarios, I can't quite pronounce that name.
Santeros, yeah.
Yes, who continue in that tradition. And they're quite different from the old Mexican tradition. There's a much greater folk art quality to the ones that are being made now, but those are quite alive and well, I believe, that tradition.
When you went to people's houses and you did the photography of these, and it's just a beautiful book with very, very lovely and just great color plates throughout the book, I find myself wondering what it would be like to actually live in one of these houses. They're almost like museums. Like, there's one picture where there's an actual dog, but as they're completely devoid of people. And you feel like you'd be scared to even take a step for fear of breaking or mussing something up.
Well, some of the houses are scary to walk into. And you certainly can knock into objects at every turn. Other houses are more spare, and the objects are highlighted and showcased, so they are an individual statement. But the others, when they're all grouped together, that's a different statement as well. And some people just love that overabundance, and it's just a way of decorating, I think.
And some of it is outdoors, too. I mean, most of the photographs are interior, mm-hmm. but some people use religious objects outside their houses as well.
Well, they can be inside, outside, anywhere. I mean, you can have religious... People have bathrooms full of religious objects. You know, any room in the house, any space outside. Works well for me.
Peter Vitale, what are some of the favorite moments that you had in putting this book together?
Oh, well... Gosh, I'll tell you some of the key moments in putting this book together. I started this book quite a long time ago, and I was actually shooting for this book in the back of my mind. It was a book that I was putting together. It wasn't really a cohesive thing. And then September 11th happened, and I happened to be shooting one of the residences at that time for this book. And then I thought, after that happened, I'm just going to really get this book published and get it done, because I think it might have more significance now for a lot of people. I believe people are sort of, were so dazed by what happened on September 11th that I think this might be a nice thing for people to see houses where spiritual art is the predominant factor in the house. And some of the other houses, just traveling around the country and even to Europe and South America, not all of those houses made it into the book, but just the travel aspect is being in a different location, a different city. That was quite a lot of fun. And what else? Just seeing the different styles and the types of houses that people put together, and just the people that you meet along the way and that collect this sort of thing. They're very interesting people.
And they must know each other, or how did you connect with them?
A lot of them do, they know each other through the dealers, because it becomes a pretty small world. It depends on what people collect. But let's say, not necessarily the Judaica, because the Judaica is very hard to find collectors of that. It's only because there's not a lot of it. There was not a lot that it was made. But certainly in collecting Christian spiritual art, yes. I mean, those people tend to know who has what and who's selling and, where to find stuff. So, yes.
Peter Vitale is the author of the book The Divine Home, Living with Spiritual Objects, and he will be at Garcia Street Books on Thursday, the 30th of October, from 5 to 6 in the afternoon, right here in Santa Fe. Thank you so much for being with us on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much. Come and see the book.
We shall. I have it in my hand right now.
Great.
We encourage people to check out Garcia Street Books and all of our local bookstores here in Santa Fe, which we are very lucky to have. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Mary Lynn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the colors of jazz. Broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We will see you tomorrow. Hasta la vista. Ciao.